to another episode of the Albion Roar here on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online at radioreverb.com, on DAB, and of course on our podcast. I'm AD Packham, and we love coming from behind in association with allfootballshirts.com. Well, last Saturday, we had the pundits purring across the land as we came from two goals down to grab a point at in-form Liverpool. There is the old adage that you don't look at the table until after you play 10 games. So, with 10 games gone, we can now take stock of our eighth position and, for a change, look up rather than down. Such has been our start to the season that Graham Potter is linked with every single managerial vacancy going, including that at Spurs before Antonio Conte took over the reins at White Hart Lane this week. Today, we welcome another side with a managerial vacancy in the shape of Newcastle, who look like they're going to be appointing Eddie Howe. We're hoping the appointment happens after the game on Saturday. Joining me today is, of course, Alan Wares, and we are delighted to welcome back the evergreen Andy Naylor from The Athletic. Andy, lovely to see you again. It's been a fantastic start, hasn't it?
Certainly has, hasn't it? Yeah, like you say, it's after 10 games, I mean, what is it, sitting eighth as we speak? You'd take that, wouldn't you, compared to the usual situation of looking around the bottom six and worrying what's behind you. That's been a really strong start.
Yeah, but I mean, we look at the start we've had, and, you know, there's been some games that have been easier than others. And the key thing is that we've been winning the games that we would ordinarily be losing or drawing, give or take the game against Norwich. How far can this team go? I mean, can we possibly challenge for like a European position, for instance?
That might be pushing the bounds of optimism a bit. But having said that, you know, you go back to Burnley, 2017-18, I think it was, wasn't it? Qualified for the Europa League. I mean, if Burnley can do it, I think Brighton in a one-off season where everything at this stage goes right is not impossible. But I think probably if you're looking at pushing at that sort of top 10, that long-term vision, I think that would be nice. Step by step, if I was choosing an ideal finish for them this season, I'd say 12th. And there's many good reasons for that, including the situation with the head coach.
Now, well, 12th would equal our best ever finish in the top flight. But I mean, Andy, I do seem to remember some dodgy side from the Potteries qualifying for Europe once, and that wasn't so long ago.
Don't get me started on them.
The thing is, AD, I think you have to be a little bit careful about what you wish for. Yes, we've made a brilliant start, and I think that a sort of a mid-table thing is actually, obviously you have to remember, is a vast improvement. Yeah, at one time we were top of the table, we were fourth, we were this, we were that, and, you know, we've slid into last year's panic of not picking up points where we frankly should have picked up more. But the other thing about it is that, and I think we're talking about the stages of the club. Andy mentioned there about Burnley, and I think Wolves had to suffer this in slight indignity, is that when they've qualified for Europe after having had a really good season, is that it really does take out of them. I remember Birmingham City had to suffer this when they won the League Cup. It really does take out of them an awful lot. If the priority is always going to be staying in the Premier League, you still want to have a good go at in the European competition. But you can't do it at the expense of being in the Premier League. So the Albion has to be in a better position, because when you saw Burnley and you saw other clubs qualifying for Europe, you saw how much they struggled the following season. The Albion still has to get, I think, a few more assets, a few more resources in place before we could actually say that, A, we're good to qualify for Europe, and B, would therefore be able to, you know, do well in that any competition.
I can't believe we're having this conversation actually on this show. it seems a bit. But I mean, West Ham, would ruin that point a little bit, because let's not forget that they were perennial strugglers for a little bit.
And yeah, but like, don't forget they've just started their European competition, so they haven't really had to suffer it yet.
But they're fighting on both fronts, and actually, they're putting out pretty strong sides in both the league and in Europe. So,
and they haven't played any of the top six yet.
Well, there is that.
The point is always, there's always exceptions to any given rule. You have to bear in mind, West Ham is a bit, if the size of Burnley and the size of Wolves, they are not totally dissimilar to the Albion. I do consider West Ham to be a bigger club, to have better resources. So I would have thought that they would actually be able to make a better fist of going into Europe. But when you consider a club of our size, you know, and yes, we are still talking, as Andy says, wild optimism at the moment. At the moment, I would bite your hand off for an eighth finish at the end of the season. But I think, yes, 12th is achievable, especially when you consider, had we taken our chances last season, then 12th wouldn't have been a million miles away. If we can do that this season, then 12th is very, very achievable.
Mm. My bigger concern really is the expectation that comes with overachievement. Yep. That's always a bit of a danger, I think. You know, so if they jump too far in one go, I say too far, it would be, you know, it would be great, wouldn't it? The higher you finish, the better. But it's what comes after that. It's what comes the season after and the season after that. You know, expectations can then jump to unrealistic levels rather than be treating it as a sort of one-off, you know, spectacular season. Sets the bar high, perhaps too high. That would be my concern.
At the moment, I fully agree with you. I mean, anything that we do by improving always has to be sustainable. And like I say, if you make that leap, it's a leap without really much of a safety net in place first. You know, let's do this step by step by step. As long as I think that the fans can see an improvement. Don't get me wrong, they see that at the start we're in fourth and fifth and the heady heights of that. But I think there's also enough realism that come the day that early in the, I think it was the first season where we were in eighth place after eight games, and it was just a sort of a run of games that had stuck us there. I just remember Mickey Adams, of all people, coming into the club and saying, enjoy eighth because it's not going to last. And he was absolutely right. And I think that's probably what we've got at the moment. We've made a good start. The frustrating thing is, we can also see, is that we already know that we've dropped points. And you think, well, if we hadn't dropped half those points, look at where we'd be. And so your rush of expectation could start getting silly. So, you know, but then, you know, and we'll talk about this, I'm sure. The emergence of a couple of players over the last three or four games has actually changed the landscape once again. So, you know, that's going to be exciting stuff to talk about and to watch.
Before we go on to Liverpool, because we are going to do that in a second. But I mean, when you talk about the emergence of these players, which players are you talking about in particular?
Specifically, the introduction of the computer. You know, he did the old famous thing of trying him out at right back, the entry level right wing back, the graveyard of all rookies, and he was found hopelessly wanting there. But then you stuck him up top. You know, he did really well when he came against Manchester City. And then you see just the energy that he can produce. And he's already in the first two or three games, he scored a couple of goals. You know, hello, finally, have we found someone who knows, you know, how to shoot, head down over the ball, that kind of thing.
Okay, let's talk about Inet Mwepu then, Andy. I mean, he's had career, and as Al said, I mean, we would think it is actually a rite of passage for every single Albion player, including Robert Sanchez, to play it right back at some point. He's come in, obviously he's had issues with traveling and quarantine and things as well, and you know, but a lot of people, when you pay a lot, I mean, I think we paid, what was it, £18 million for him, I think. When you pay that amount of money for people, you expect them to hit the ground running. But sometimes it does take time to settle at a club, and it's beginning to happen.
Yeah, I think, I'm not sure on the exact fee. I think it might have been a bit less than that. Thing is with signings, particularly when they're coming from overseas, it's each case is different. You know, some players settling straight away. You think about Pascal Gross when he first came. You know, others, it takes a bit of time, particularly when you look at the difficulties Enoch has faced. I mean, actually, from the opening day at Burnley, which was not really his fault, he was substituted at half-time because there was a complete sort of reshuffle by Graham because of the way that game was going. Then, as you've referenced, he's had injury, COVID-related problems for him from the start. But I think we're now beginning to see evidence of why Brighton signed him in the summer. A different case with the other major signing, Mark Cucurella, who has hit the ground running and looked sort of as if he'd been in the Premier League for 2-3 seasons since the moment he played at Brentford.
Yeah, absolutely. And Cucurella has been a revelation like that as well. And like, I mean, how much of you would you put that down to? I mean, I know he does it with all of the players, but particularly the ones that come from Spanish speaking countries, but the impact that Bruno has on those sort of players.
Yeah, I think obviously Bruno plays a part. He's in that coaching team that Graham Potter's got now, isn't he? And of course, sort of a fullback as well, albeit on the other side of the defence. But like I say, there's no kind of magic formula for these signings. You just have to take each one individually. Some come in straight away. Some it take a season. Take more than a season. I think we're now seeing with Leandro Trossard that progression. He's another example now that he's had, this is his third season. He's really starting to flourish. So you just have to be a bit patient. Regardless, I know for Brighton that's a lot of money, but in the context of the Premier League, we're not talking massive fees.
Well, no. Well, look at Jack Grealish. I mean, they paid 100 million for him, and they still can't afford to give him proper socks. let's move on to the game on Saturday then, Liverpool. It's all about Graham Potter's tactical dexterity, really. I mean, there was a few people that were surprised when he didn't name a striker in the starting lineup with Neil Maupay on the bench. But when you look at the side, Andy, that finished against Man City and the way that we're playing against them, it wasn't that much of a surprise.
Well, I don't think there can be a better example of innovative thinking than looking at the way Graham has responded to losing Danny Welbeck out until, hopefully, the latest suggestion from Graham was perhaps this side of New Year. But you wouldn't have imagined too many people. The solution to that would be to leave out your top goal scorer. That's effectively what's happened. You know, Neil came off against Man City. You then had that sort of Solly March and Leandro Trossard combination in the pockets. And then Leandro, a slight tweak to that at Anfield as the false nine, if you like.
The dawn of the false nine, Andy. But
I think that's a really interesting response, you know, to that situation, to losing Danny Welbeck.
But I mean, if you look back to last season when we actually beat Man City, we started that game with Danny Welbeck in the side, and he went off injured. We didn't have Maupay at the time because he was suspended, and we carried on in that game in a style that we finished the game against them last Saturday. So, you know, it does work. I mean, he tried playing a system with no strikers against Arsenal. Was it last season? I think when we lost 1-0,
yeah.
With McAllister playing furthest forward, that didn't quite gel for us that night, but it's another option. And, you know, and the players have to have this, like I'll use that phrase again, like tactical dexterity.
Well, the only thing I'd reference with the City game last season was they were down to 10 men pretty early on in that one. And also, it was a slightly different context, wasn't it, coming towards the end of the season when they'd already won the league. So, I think we've seen that kind of dexterity all over the pitch, haven't we? Certainly in the way Graham's used players, pushing them, I think, beyond the boundaries of their own expectations and the way they see themselves.
Alan?
Well, yeah, no, I was just going to say is that I think that, again, we're back to Andy's point about expectations is, okay, someone is signed as a striker, someone is signed as a midfielder or as a wide person or stuff like that. I think when it comes to Graham Potter, you can throw that largely out the window. Not totally. I mean, a centre-back is still a centre-back. I struggle to see the day when I'll see Shane Duffy out on the wing. But then having said that, I think we all thought that when Dan Burns signed. So again, all bets are off. So when it comes to, you know, a false nine, which Garth Crooks hates so much so he wouldn't stick Mepo in his team of the week because of the, not because how well he played, but because he doesn't like the tactic. but yeah, when you've got McAllister playing further forward, when you've got Solly March is at left back, when you've got, Sanchez starting the move against Liverpool, I'd say you, and we've all done it, come 2 o'clock or 6:45 or whatever it is, and we see Graham Potter's team sheet, even if it's unchanged from last week, you're still thinking, okay, it's the same team, but is it going to be the same formation? Because you get to realise that certain players are so flexible or have been made to be so flexible in the position that they're going to be playing. So the notion of Danny Welbeck, centre-forward, no, he plays up wide. Mope, yes, but he'll then sort of like, he'll skirt off over there. You know, McAllister, he's an attacking midfielder, but sometimes he'll play as a striker. Ditto Mwepu. So absolutely everything is up for grabs. And like I say, it's one of those great fun things that when you see the team sheet come out, the next thing is the guessing game. Is he going to play 4 at the back? Is he going to play 5 at the back? Is, you know, is Lamptey going to go in goal? Is, you know, and you have no idea. And I think that's part of the fun of watching Brighton, because you turn up and what you're not going to see usually is a staged solid performance. What you're going to see is a bit of fluidity. And in this instance, Liverpool didn't know what hit them in the second half.
Andy?
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, the thing about the comeback at Anfield was, I think I'm right in saying, what is it? 244 times Liverpool led by at least... 250 times had led by at least 2 goals in the Premier League at Anfield, and on 244 of those occasions had won. So that kind of puts into context how rare it is for teams to come back from that sort of position at Anfield. But they deserved to, didn't they? Over the piece, they deserved to.
And look how close we came to winning as well, but for a shoelace.
Yeah. Yeah, but let's also not forget, I mean, we were... a VAR call away from actually going 3-0 down in that game. And with that, we did that against Man City. We came back and had a much better second half display when the game had probably already gone. So, and the fact, I mean, let's face it. I mean, Mane with that third goal, he should have been playing at the Copper Box. That's where handball's played, isn't it? We rose above that, and obviously we had that Solly March chance in the first minute as well, where he was totally lonely. I mean, it was a brilliant ball from Trossard to find him, and his first touch possibly let him down a little bit, which took him away from goal. But you would expect to see the cavalry arriving in the box on that one, and no one came, and he had to take the shot on himself. And what happens? They go up the other end and score straight away, Andy.
Yeah. Well, I think what was really interesting again was that Graham probably identifying the fact that the best way to get at Liverpool was running off the back of their midfield. And that's what we saw Brighton doing on countless occasions, particularly in the second half.
Yeah, and we also, I mean, there's tactical tweaks going on all over the place. I mean, the interview with Adam Lallana after the game was particularly... engaging, and it gave away an awful lot of information on that, about the fact that a lot of people thought that he'd made the change, made the tactical tweak at half time, but it actually happened before half time because Lallana dropped deep to match Henderson because he was getting too much of the ball.
Well, there was another example of how actually Graham changed things to start with, didn't he? Because we'd seen Adam Lallana in that deeper role all season this season, but that's not the way he started at Anfield. He was pushed a bit further forward. So that was just yet another example of Graham tweaking.
Yeah. I mean,
stays the same, does it, within a game or from game to game?
Yeah, I mean, there's certainly a lot of plus points to talk about in this game, but there's also some negatives we've got to look at as well. And I mean, Liverpool are capable of scoring at a canter from most positions, but the goals we did concede, even the ones that were ruled out, were, you look at where the defenders were, I was left scratching my head a little bit.
Well, you could argue that about any goal that anyone scores anywhere.
Yeah, you were always, obviously, if you're the team that have conceded goals, you're always going to pick apart how those goals have happened, aren't you? And find little instances, moments where things they could have perhaps done better. But I think we have got to bear in mind, we are talking really elite level here. You know, when you're playing Man City and Liverpool, you're talking about two of the best teams on the planet. So you've really got to take that into consideration when trying to sort of pick holes in perhaps the way they've tried to stop Liverpool. You know, this apart from anything else, they're a very free scoring side, aren't they? You know, they don't just do that against Brighton.
Let's put it this way: if we had the quality up front to ping in a cross that would land on a fella's head every single time. I mean, this is it. Every time a Liverpool cross came in, it would have been headed out. And you think, well, was that good defending or was it a poor cross? I mean, it depends on your perspective. If a Brighton cross goes in, someone will say, oh, it was a poor cross. If a Liverpool one comes in, they say, oh, it was either a poor... The whole thing of picking apart the defence because you've conceded. I mean, you know, there's a similarity between Henderson's goal and Mwepu. Admittedly, Mwepu's is a bit further out, looks a bit more spectacular, but the way they took it, you know, on what you would probably call the wrong foot when you're shooting towards goal, because it's one of the arcs away from the goal. But, you know, they're very similar and the techniques were superb. And yet, you know, the ball was played back to Henderson. He shot, he scored. The ball was played back to Mwepu. He shot, he scored. You know, are Liverpool going to have a post-mortem about that defending? Because let's face it, in both cases, neither did a shot at the time really look on.
Yeah. I mean, Henderson did arrive really, really late onto that. And like Lallana just couldn't keep up with him at that particular moment.
Well, so, you know, and with Salah's offside goal, again, I mean, it cancels out with Trossard's one. The ball was played through. They went up half a pace too early. You know, took it past the keeper nicely and slotted it home. You know, so in which case, those two, you could argue, would cancel each other out. Where was Liverpool defence? Where was the Brighton defence? You know, I think you're being a little bit harsh here, AD, unless you actually want to, you know, go full pelt at Liverpool's defence as well, in which case, knock yourself out.
Well, there were similarities between the way that our goals, the goal that we had disallowed and the one that Trossard scored. They were both coming through central areas. But I mean, I just wanted to touch on the third Liverpool goal that got disallowed. But where as Adam Lallana said,
we hang were on, they had two disallowed goals. Which one do you mean? Right.
The Mane one, the handball one.
Right.
Where we're, like, as Adam Lallana says, we are faffing about with it. There's been a couple of mistakes creeping in, Andy, with Robert Sanchez. I mean, you've just done a brilliant piece on his year in the first team. So, I mean, where do you think he is? And there has been, there was that one which could have been a killer goal. There was the mistake he made against Norwich when he came out and missed the ball. I mean, he's well in credit. He saves us more points than he loses us. But there are a couple of errors.
You're talking
errors.
About two mistakes over a year.
Well, that is the point, really. You've just answered the question, really. He's well in credit. So often, I think you've got to look at the overall picture. And here we are. We're talking about a lad who's 23 years of age who, at the two summers ago, was Brighton's fourth choice goalkeeper. That's how it started. If it hadn't been for Christian Walton's injury in the pre-season friendly against Chelsea, at that stage, Robert Sanchez is looking like being Brighton's fourth choice goalkeeper. He's obviously still young. He's not the finished article yet, but there is so much to like, so much potential there, both with his hands and with his feet. So let's not sort of pick apart and crucify him every time he has had bad moments or has made a mistake, because the overall impact he's had on Brighton's performances in the time he's been between the posts far outweighs those moments. And I'd also say on the one at Anfield, that probably in a different situation, Lewis Dunk might not make the decision to pass to him in that situation. You know, it's all about decision making at times. It's going to go wrong sometimes. And you notice, don't you, at the Amex, the crowd still get very, oh, you almost feel these sharp intakes of breath when the ball is going back and you know, they're worrying about it, playing out from the back, playing passes with his feet. The flip side is, look what he did for the equaliser.
Yeah, absolutely.
He started that move. The game I keep coming back to that was very fresh in my mind when I did the piece with our goalkeeping expert, Matt, who was brilliant, by the way, fascinating insight, was the Palace game. I remember two instances that night.
Sorry, which Palace game?
The one away early in the season, the 1-1 draw, okay. where his distribution, his long-range distribution, twice turned defence into attack. Yes. I think it was Danny Welbeck on both occasions. You know, he's an exceptional young talent. And
can I also throw in that case, the corresponding fixture at Liverpool last year, the one where we won 1-0, last minute of the game, the last couple of minutes of the game, Liverpool have got a corner. And don't forget, we're not talking about a fella who's a year into his Brighton career. He's about 12 minutes into his Brighton career. His games is probably single figures at the time. Corner comes in. He absolutely steamrolls everyone to claim that ball. 23 years old, playing at Anfield, admittedly an empty Anfield, but he's playing at Anfield, last minute of the game. He's made a decision which could easily blow up in his face. He's come in, he's claimed the ball. It's like scoring a goal. It was brilliant. And you're thinking, that was the moment I'm thinking he'll do for us. You know, Ben Roberts clearly sees something in him. Have you, Andy, had a chance to speak to Ben Roberts about him?
Not in great detail, no, but I know when I have how highly Ben rates him. He certainly sort of going back last season and when he'd been out on loan. It's funny you mentioned that, Eddie. Also, the same similar instance at a full Anfield last Saturday. There was a free kick in injury time when Tarek Lamptey got booked. And again, that free kick, I think it was 3 minutes into injury time, he came quite to claim it.
I absolutely love that.
Occasionally, it's going to go wrong, as it did in a different situation against Man City, as it did, what was it, Burnley, early on. You're just going to have to accept that, because like I say, the benefits far outweigh the disadvantages.
Okay, but before we move on to this, I just want to quickly mention a guy we've mentioned in dispatches there already, which was the impact that Tarek Lamptey had when he came on, and that run that he made that left Andy Robertson on his backside. If Trossard's run had just been a fraction...
If, mate.
Yeah, it would have been the winning goal. But I mean, what an impact, and it's a delight to have him back, Andy.
Well, yeah. Again, what we're seeing is the sort of gradual in terms of minutes building up, and we're seeing more and more with each step him getting back to the kind of influence that he had before the injury. And I have to say, it does make me laugh a bit on social media sometimes when I see the sort of, well, I'm assuming they are medical experts venturing their opinions about what should be done with Tarek in terms of how many minutes he's getting. The medical department, no.
the medical department
is challenged. They've been fairly careful with him. Too right. This is a young lad who was out for, what was it, 10 months. He's got his whole career ahead of him. The type of injury it is, he is.
Yeah, I've seen people on social media who are clearly medically qualified, got their certificate, I think, at Woolies, saying, because I think he had an injury and then a sort of a bit of a relapse into it, saying that the entire medical staff should be sacked. And you think, go away. Just, you know, I mean, reading it is one thing. It's like then a little bit of sick appears in your eyes because it's you've just seen that and you realise that they're out there. The idiocy is almost in its purest form. And so, you know, it's just following in from that. Yeah, the number of people who know how to manage Tarek Lamptey's injury above and beyond sort of probably medically qualified people. But yeah, it's great. The fact he's coming back, you know, Potter has said many times his comeback is going to be managed. I mean, when you see him herring down the wing, which he did against Liverpool and he did it a couple of times, you know, he showed Jack Grealish how to twist and turn and get a cross in without needing to put yourself on your backside first. But you can't help feeling that there's, you know, that, you know, you're talking about, Andy, about the passing around the back and there's this sharp intake of breath. Because and 95 times out of 100, it'll work okay. I can't help feeling that with Tarek Lamptey as well. When you see him herring off down the line saying, be careful, be careful. Don't snap your leg again. Right. You know, because you really want to preserve something as magical as Lamptey's talent.
Well, I for one, I hope he's unleashed from the start at the weekend.
Well, yeah.
St. James's Park last. Got taken off just, but it was just after. Was it just before or just after half time? I can't remember. But he,
well, up there,
blood.
Yes.
Up there, no, it was on about
just before the hour. That was the game, wasn't it? That was his away debut, and yeah, that was the game where he kind of burst onto the scene, really. I think.
And I remember
it was the game where Jamie Carragher tweeted, "Love Lamptey."
I remember listening back to the Five Live commentary. And he was substituted on 63 minutes or something like that. And you could hear the commentator go something like, there's a Brighton substitution. Oh, no. Oh, no. Tarek Lamptey's coming off. And you could hear, because these guys were having an absolute ball describing this tiny bundle of rocket fuel.
He was
sublime that day. That was the day when Bissouma decided to kick one of the Newcastle players in the face as well.
It was indeed, yeah. But it was a 3-0 win away from home. And we all love those. Okay, well, you are listening to Reverb 97.2 FM online at RadioReverb.com on DAB. As ever, we are brought to you in association with the brilliant oldfootballshirts.com. And there's been a bit of a mixed opinion about this shirt. I, for one, love it. Al hates it. Andy, what do you think?
Not a fan, I don't think. No. There's just too much going on in it, isn't there?
I'll tell you what, just for once, Aidy, just for once, you describe it.
Me? I'll describe it. Hang on, let me bring it up again. Hang on. Here we go. So basically, I mean, Al, you described it as it looked a little bit like a tennis shirt.
Yeah, and the reason I didn't like it is because I hate tennis. It's a stupid game.
I mean, it's got a little bit of Crystal Palace colours on it, which is, I mean, it's basically what it is. It's a white shirt made by Umbro with some sort of like weird pyramid-y, broken pyramid Crystal Palace lines at the bottom. I mean, it kind of looks a bit like a PSG away shirt is what I thought first.
I love the way you say that, because you're the one that knows what it is. So
I do know what it is, and it's not a PSG away shirt.
No, it's not a PSG away shirt.
It's not. But do you want to have a guess at the year and the country, guys?
I mean, look at the number of colours on there. We've got red, blue, white, black, green. Oh, it's just a bit of a mess, really, isn't it?
Sponsored by Tostem, which is written in green and black on a white and...
The only reason I'm going to go for this, AD, that the fact that it's red and blue, is I see the city of Genoa in these colours. So I'm going to say, totally randomly, an away shirt of Sampdoria.
That is incorrect.
I frankly haven't got the faintest idea, other than...
It's not Stoke, Andy. It's not
Stoke.
I don't
know. I'm
right.
Are we going? I think we're going for. Are we talking?
We are further afield, yes.
Are we talking? I don't. Are we talking Asia? Something like
yes.
that?
Yes.
Oh, blimey.
I mean, I can't go beyond that. I've got no idea.
vast continent of Asia.
Okay. Well, there we go. Well, I'll put you out of your misery. This is the... this is your shirt of the week, chosen because I can, says Phil. This is the 1997 away shirt of J1 League side, Kashima Antlers. The J1 League is the top level of professional football in Japan. The league was formed in 1992. Prior to that, the top flight was Japanese Soccer League, which is an amateur league. Kashima Antlers don't have a nickname because they're Japanese and therefore are far more interested in whiskey, adult comics, and dubious vending machines. They play at the 40,728 capacity Kashima Soccer Stadium, which has no other name either. The side was formed in 1947 and the franchise was moved to Kashima in 1975, where they yo-yoed in the JSLs until the formation of the J-League in 1993. Since then, they have gone on to become the most successful side in professional Japanese football and one of just two sides to have competed in the top flight every year since its inception, the other one being Yokohama F. Marinos. They've won the league 8 times, the League Cup 6 times, and the Emperor's Cup 5 times, and they've also won the Asian Champions League in 2018. The current squad is a Japanese with a Korean goalie and a smattering of Brazilians. And there seems to be a synergy between the side and Brazil as the current director of football is none other than the legendary Zico, who played for the side between 1991 and 94 before retiring. To the UK, let alone anything linked to the Albion, you just have to enjoy the shirt. Oh, and a Plymouth Argyle shirt from 1990 was added to old football shirts this week. And it was a shirt number 120,000. So cheers to everyone who has contributed to the site over the years. 120,000 shirts now, Phil. That's amazing.
That's slightly obsessive.
I can't believe we didn't get it. Can you?
just one of 120,000 shirts we could have chosen from, which usually, to be fair, he does choose some obscure third division Mexican side that where the president is shot on a daily basis. Or each team member gets poisoned by some godforsaken insect that only lives at 15,000 feet. That's Phil's usual thing. So J League, thanks, mate. I mean, we really got that easily.
Well, Phil didn't actually put any Japanese in there for me this week. Perhaps he knows that I once had Japanese lessons when I was working for Virgin. But
no one cares. No one cares.
I'm much going to say.
Talking of Japanese, AD.
Yes.
You could have been my interpreter when I spoke to Mr. Matama a few weeks ago.
Oh, you've actually spoken to him. Let's talk about Kuru. So it's Matoma, it's not Mitama.
It doesn't matter to me. I write. I know.
Good point. Well made. Okay, so... I mean, he's an interesting character. Obviously, he's just been called up by Japan, which will boost his chances of possibly coming to us in January, if the rumours are led to be believed. I mean, he's currently tearing it up for Tony's other side, Union Saint-Gilloise, who are currently top of the Jupiler League, Andy.
Yeah, they've really started with a bang, haven't they, after promotion last season?
It's good.
Interesting to see. I'm not sure, but it might be a bit premature, I think, the January suggestions. I'm not convinced about that. It might well be that he spends the season in Brussels. But another interesting signing, isn't he? When you look at his background and widening the net again, such a cosmopolitan squad that Brighton have got now, both the players currently at the club and those out on loan.
I'm
going to just say, AD, I mean, it's kind of fascinating for anyone who's ever been to Brussels, and it's a kind of a funny city. I mean, when you think of Brussels, you think of certain Sir Boston Tufton's huffing and puffing about how much they've ruined our lives or anything like that. But let's face it, we're talking about an ancient city here of a trading city, a cultural city, a commercial city. And in the outskirts, in a part of Brussels called Gilloire, which, although the club has now moved to an area called Forêt, lies Union Saint-Gilloire, probably about the second or third, maybe the fourth size Brussels football entity. You can't really compare it with London, which has got sort of four or five or seven Premier League sides. So you think the third largest one would be West Ham or Chelsea or whatever it might be. You can't really think of it in those terms. But you've got this stadium that's in the middle of this suburban residential area. It really doesn't look, when you see it on Google Maps, it really doesn't look like it should be there. But Tony Bloom has bought into this place. I think he's the majority shareholder. I don't know if he has the controlling interest, because let's face it, on a day-to-day basis, he's got his work cut out doing everything else. But what the history of Union Saint-Gilloire is that certainly in the 20s and 30s, they were the Belgian side. I suppose the closest equivalent you could have would be someone like Huddersfield or Sunderland, an ancient football club with great tradition.
Stanley?
No, we're talking about a club that used to get to the cup finals and used to win all the time. Accrington Stanley have never won anything. We're talking about a club who, and have fallen since on harder times, but in these past three or four seasons have had a resurrection in a way that clearly Huddersfield and Sunderland haven't. I'm talking about an ancient and cherished football club in this instance in the suburbs of Brussels, and at the moment they sit pretty about two or three points clear at the top of the Jupiler League, and we're talking ahead of Bruges, ahead of Anderlecht, ahead of Standard Liège, and all those other major Belgian clubs who have actually experienced European success. So this is the first time, certainly post-war, that Union Saint-Gilloire have really sort of hit the big time. Now what that's got to do with Tony and how he runs the club, I don't know, because I don't know about the nature of his day-to-day hands-on experience. But what I would say is there's been a couple of games I've watched. And if we're talking about Mitoma here, who scored a second-half hat-trick after USG had been 2-0 down and came back to win 4-2.
With 10 men as well.
Sorry?
With 10 men as well.
With 10 men and won it at a canter. You get to realise that actually, not only has Tony got something really good going on in England, he's got something major going on in Belgium. Now, whether that can translate from someone playing in Belgium to playing in England, in other words, Mitoma coming over here and tearing up the trees that he's been doing that surround the Saint-Gilloire Stadium, yeah, is another matter. But it's very, very exciting to see that, you know, whatever Tony sort of puts his hand to, somewhere down the line, there seems to be a certain amount of success to it.
Yeah, well, it worked really well for Percy Tau, didn't it? But before we move on from there, I just want to quickly mention, you mentioned Bruges there. I just want to say how delighted I am to see Jose Escuero back and playing again. And he's a player who I absolutely adored at the Albion. And I'm glad to see that he's managed to find a home and he's hit the ground running again.
You know, you say that, you know, when the Albion aren't playing at home, we trot over to Worthing. I mean, for those who listen to this, both myself and AD, we live in various parts of Worthing. AD's in East Worthing. I'm over by Goring nowadays. And yet we do go and see Worthing, and Worthing are getting very, very good crowds here. We're talking tier seven and they're getting 1500 people each week, week in, week out, which in European terms, tier seven getting those number of people, well, is unprecedented. You go to tier seven in France or Spain or Italy, and you get one man and his dog, and the dog will probably having a good poop on the side of the pitch anyway. But when you go to Worthing, you get 1500 people in, and it's absolutely brilliant. So my point would be is that if you ever get the chance, I think it's probably one of those things where you go to Belgium, you're probably going to get to see some damn good football, you know, irrespective of their national team and their current players doing well in the other leagues. You know, there's some decent football going on in Belgium as well.
Absolutely. Okay, well, let's move on from there. We're going to just quickly talk about the other international call-ups or they're in lack of. It's another international break. It really disrupts the rhythm. And this is what, the third one we've had
I think it's the last really, one before March, though, isn't it?
Oh, I hope so, because they're really annoying me now.
Mate, have you seen what's coming up in December? Then you'll realise what annoying is.
We haven't even got on to the fact that the Palace game's been moved yet, but we'll come to that. Gareth Southgate famously said, "Oh yeah, I'm always going to pick players on form rather than favouritism." So you got someone like Tyrone Mings, who's just been dropped to the bench because he's out of form, and he's back in the squad again ahead of an in-form Lewis Dunk again. I don't think Lewis is ever going to play for England again, is he?
I think that ship sailed quite a while ago, to be frank with you. I mean, one sort of, if you like, defence of Gareth Southgate, I think that whoever is in charge of England, you're always going to get this with every squad announcement. You know, people looking at individuals from the clubs that they're attached to, that watch on a regular basis, comparing and saying, well, why is he in and why he isn't? But, you know, we've also got to take into account his record as England head coach. He hasn't done too badly, has he, in the last couple of tournaments? But I must say, the surprise to me, I'm a bit puzzled by what's happening with Ben White. That's the one that surprises me.
Because he's not included either.
Because he came into the squad, obviously, in the Euros. I'm not surprised that he was sort of left out initially, perhaps of the previous 1-2 squads. I'm surprised that he's not back in now, because I think we're beginning to see Arsenal, that early narrative of what a waste of money, £50 million being too much. I still think that in the long run, that will look a good deal for all parties.
Okay, well, let's talk about that then, because, I mean, what are your colleagues at The Athletic saying about Ben?
About Ben? I think my Arsenal colleagues are pretty impressed by what they're beginning to see with him in that Arsenal defence, playing in a back four, because there was a lot of discussion, wasn't there? Maybe he needs to play with two other central defenders. Look at the way Arsenal defend, it's not just Ben. Obviously, Ramsdale's had a big impact, but I think you could see with Arsenal for a long time that was the area that they really needed to sort out, and they just didn't recruit well enough in that area. Mm. I think we've seen that change now, and we're seeing the start of a team. I predicted at the start of the season, actually, that Arsenal might surprise a few people, and maybe with a young, energetic team, might finish around 5th, 6th. Looked like having egg on my face early on, and I wasn't that impressed with them, to be fair, at the Amex. I thought Brighton outplayed them and really should have won, could have won and should have won. But I think there were the signs of that team coming together.
The thing is, I think an awful lot was asked of, let's face it, a rookie. He had one season in the Premier League. You know, for the fact that Brighton turned down 30 million, allegedly turned down 30 million from Leeds for him at the beginning of the season, and then Arsenal piling with 50 million, then, you know, does that mean that this was always Brighton's valuation? Or, you know, you can come up with the conspiracy theories as to how someone is going to value someone. But let's face it, we're talking about, within Brighton's defence, a rookie, someone who needed looking after in that defence. So by the time he's actually gone to Arsenal, having had one year in the Premier League, two with a £50 million price tag on his head, I mean, everything seems to scream that actually that Arsenal are asking too much of a young fella, especially to help sort out a defence that frankly had hitherto been a mess. And I'm just wondering if there's any consideration as to, you know, amongst the press pack that you're with, as to, you know, how Ben has actually has responded to that challenge.
Yeah, I just think he's a class act. I really do. I think everything I've seen with Ben, every step that he's taken, that's been that progression, hasn't it? Every challenge he's faced, he's met. And I really do think that will continue with Arsenal. Like I say, down the line, I really think that deal will look actually pretty good business for everyone.
Yeah.
For Brighton, the money they got, for Arsenal, the fee they paid, and for Ben in terms of the progression of his career.
Yeah. It was the potential which they bought, and it was a hell of a lot of potential. But speaking of the potential, there's one player which we've got that has got potential in by the bag load, but doesn't seem to be showing an awful lot of it at the moment. He's just a player, again, with the international call-ups, has been excluded from the Republic of Ireland squad, which is Aaron Connolly. I mean, we about him. What do you do with him?
Well, if you actually look back, I think he was a bit unlucky because he had the loan, didn't he? He went to Luton, but he went injured and barely played at Luton. So the bit that's probably been missing with Aaron is a really good loan spell. And you know, then he had that explosive start, didn't he? The Spurs game. And we talked about expectations. You know, that set the bar pretty high, didn't it?
And
he hasn't really lived up to those expectations since then. He's going through a difficult time. You know, the Swansea game, he shone, didn't he, against Championship opposition, albeit.
Yeah, some very sharp finishes in that game. It shows he can actually do it.
Yeah. So I think, again, I'd just urge patience. He's still only 21. It feels like he's been around a lot longer than that, doesn't it? He's still only 21. He's had one or two injury problems, well, more than one or two little niggles. It's not easy for a player of that kind of age to command a regular place in a forward line in the Premier League. Patience, maybe might work out well for him. Might be
Could well do. Now, aim that we've seen banded around this week with anyone who's interested is that of Graham Potter. Obviously, to be linked with big. It's getting more and more worrying than the noise that's building around him, isn't it?
I don't think immediately. Short-term worrying. I think the number of jobs that would appeal to Graham Potter set against what he's got at Brighton is actually quite small. Because I think you've got to take into account the structure he's got around. You know, Paul Barber, chief executive, day-to-day running the club on Tony Bloom's behalf, the chair. You know, a fan who's thrown, as we know, so much money at the club and continues to make money available within the bound of the club's capacity in terms of transfer fees and wages. Dan Ashworth, the technical director. You look at that setup around him. That is, I would say, that's top four class. I really do think, you know, if those guys were operating at Liverpool, Man City, you wouldn't be surprised. Mm. So he's got that structure around him. He's got his staff with him who he had at Ostersunds and at Swansea. Bruno, of course, you mentioned before, Ben Roberts, two highly regarded former players at the club. That's a really good structure that enables him to kind of exhibit his coaching talents. So I really think it would need to be a significant jump up from that to really interest him. I think the danger comes perhaps in the summer, and it goes back to what we said about Brighton. If they do really well, obviously the better they do, the more attention he's going to get. And I just wonder then that if they do fly above and finish what we were talking about, then I think the fear then is you look at it and think, how much better can he then do at Brighton? and that if another bigger and better opportunity came, then he might be. He might be.
I think that you also have to consider
to take it in those circumstances.
I think possibly you also have to consider that there's the level to which Graham Potter himself will believe that he has taken the project that he is currently undertaking himself, is has he taken it as far as he could go? I think that, you know, given now you've met him several times, Andy, obviously, and the rest of us really haven't, but there seems to be a kind of a sophistication and an appreciation of the support that you've actually just mentioned there. He appreciates those around him. And I think he also realizes that that sort of thing isn't necessary. I think this is the point you're making, is it's not necessarily there at the bigger clubs even. You see some bigger clubs, they'll throw resources at an issue. But I hark back to Ole Gunnar Solskjaer has had the problem of the returning Cristiano Ronaldo, where it filled a problem that he didn't have. The other problems that he did have, that he wanted to actually have fulfilled, weren't dealt with. Now, that sort of thing wouldn't necessarily happen at Brighton. It would be down to the manager saying, I need this. And therefore, the rest of the infrastructure works around that. Whereas at Manchester United, and I'm citing this as an example, Manchester United have got in Cristiano Ronaldo in order just to get a few quid in. And it hasn't necessarily helped them. Don't get me wrong, we're talking about a world-class talent, but it hasn't helped the team or the club specifically. And Graham Potter, should he wish to say, I wish to try my talents elsewhere, has to know that the very things, the support structure that he has at Brighton and Hove Albion, he has to know he has it at his target club. And there are very few people, and this is where Andy's point is saying about top four, where it's a case of what is the club that is going to, A, allow him to have that, to give him the head that he needs in order to operate the way that he does. Are they going to allow that half season where actually the club in question is actually struggling? He's actually had to go down in order to go up again because of X, Y, Z.
The problem with Manchester United is that they haven't got a director of football, and that's what they've needed for a very long time. And basically, there's no structure.
It's the whole structure. And the point is, and this is what Grant, this is what actually being will make Brighton and Hove Albion attractive to the next person. And the next person is someone that the Albion themselves has to be interested in. We're not going to go on that Sam Allardyce, Mark Hughes carousel, because we're frankly way above that. But we are talking something in the higher stratosphere of having, not necessarily the talent on the pitch, which is why we're not a top four side. But what we do have is the structure off the pitch to actually have that, to have a club which is not necessarily going to punch above its weight, but has the potential to do so much better than it currently is.
Well, that's a debate we're going to have another day, and we'll have another day, because that is all we've got time for this week. So thank you, of course, to Alan West. Thank you to Andy Naylor. This has been the Albion Roar on Radio Reverb, 97.2 FM, online at radioreverb.com, on DAB, and of course on a podcast. I'm Eddie Packham, and we will be back with you again next week, hopefully not having this conversation again.